The number 38. Why is that such a unique and special number?
38. That's specific. Why 38?
You'll have to watch the podcast to work out why. I still don't know why talking about it makes you chuckle. And then also, what leads to a person paying millions of dollars for a service?
There'll be a sales methodology within that organization for how they conduct their enterprise sales. And a lot of that will be around how they qualify and validate opportunities they're going to pursue. If the potential payoff is 10 million, but the chance of success is below 38%, are you going to pursue it?
How do you communicate that in a way that will inspire people to take action, and what's involved to enable you to do that? And also, what does number 38 have to do with this podcast? All right, let's kick into it.
Cool.
See what happens.
Sounds good.
So I already asked you what you do off here, but you know, we can ask on here too. So just
why not?
Yeah. What would you do? You got two practices now.
Thanks, Ryan. My name's Simon Yock. I am the growth scientist. What does that mean? That means I help businesses with their sales and marketing. Actually, primarily their sales. I'm a consultant. Does that mean I just coach and advise? No. One of my key points of difference is I get down in the weeds. With a bunch of my clients, I actually help them execute on their sales to grow their revenue. That's me in a nutshell.
Boom. I feel like you practiced that pitch a few times. Have you stood in the front of the mirror and you've been like practicing tonality and pausing? And
first time I've done that one.
Oh, is it? Yeah, like good man. Good stuff. Well, let's go back a little way back just to set the scene. What's So where were you born? Were you born in Auckland or were you born
in... I was indeed born in Auckland. Auckland born and bred and raised.
Oh, yeah.
But I've lived in all different parts of the world. I've lived in Israel. I've lived in America. Did a summer camp teaching overprivileged kids how to play tennis.
Overprivileged kids. Yeah. Okay.
Certainly not underprivileged kids.
Yeah, geez.
Had a fantastic time living on a kibbutz in Israel to follow back to my Jewish heritage.
What's a kibbutz?
A kibbutz is the Jewish communities, actually akin to communes, that formed the Jewish settlements in Israel before the state of Israel itself existed. So pre-1948, when it was good old Palestine, and the Jewish settlers wanted to return to the Holy Land, was quite a challenging thing to do. So around, I think maybe just after the First World War, some of the Jews of Europe wanted to return to the Holy Land, and they came up with this idea of creating their own self-sufficient settlements within Palestine. And these are kibbutzes. They grow their own food, they feed their own people, they teach their own people. And typically communities of maybe about 500 people and still exist and represent about 5% of the Jewish population of Israel today.
Wow, random. Yeah. I've been to Israel.
Ah, whereabouts have you been?
Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Yep.
I was there when Trump tried to move the embassy and they're like, everyone get out of the fucking Jerusalem. I'm like, eh, we'll see what happens. There's no lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are you quite knowledgeable in the world of Jewish faith? And could I ask you questions about what's it called? Starts with T, doesn't it?
The Torah?
Torah, yeah. Do you know anything about it?
You could, but you probably wouldn't get anything of meaning from me.
Oh, jeez.
Look, one thing I do know, Judaism is a matriarchal society. So if your mother's not Jewish, then you're not Jewish. So my grandfather was the last Jew in our family because he didn't marry a Jewish wife. And that killed it all dead.
Do you think that's partly by design to keep it going? Like why it has to be a matriarchal?
Who knows? Who knows? The Jews are fascinating people. They're living on the kibbutz, climbed up to Masada.
Masada, okay.
The volunteer leader, her husband, who had passed away before her, had been the volunteer leader. Story goes, he passed away in his 70s. No volunteer ever beat him up Masada, even when he was taking people up in his 70s. The power and passion of these people is something to behold. You don't mess with the Jews. Bad things happen if you try to.
Interesting. Jesus. This is a dangerous topic. Palestine and Israel, and you went straight into it. I was just talking to another guy the other day that was getting fired up about Palestine, and I love Israel, like it, because...
Yes.
I travel around the world, and it's just America number two. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, yeah, I've seen that before. Israel's just like fucking out the gate. It's so different. And then you got the people that are meant to be dressing modestly in their black suits, but it's like Armani. And they got the little pigtails and shit. And they're holding hands and dancing.
Yep.
What was your time like? We won't go on the Palestinian unless you want to.
I spent time in the West Bank.
Oh, yeah.
I spent time with Arabs in the West Bank drinking Arabic tea, sort of stuff that's so strong you can't even put a spoon in it because it'll break the spoon. The coffee's so strong it'll keep you awake for 4 days on end. Just so different, yet they look so similar. I've been to Northern Ireland as well. I think there are lots of parallels between Palestine and Israel and Northern Ireland and the Republic, right? One people historically, but a difference in religion. It's a shame.
Yeah, I was so fascinated doing the religious journey. Like, I'm atheist can be, but I think there's a lot of lessons around religion and the symbolism and how to approach life in a way. It's like, I saw this visual of the Bible, and it was how many times it's cross-referenced.
Yes, right.
And it was just this beautiful plethora of rainbow-colored thousands and thousands. It's quite a fascinating. What was there anything that stood out to you while you're in Israel that you're this is where Jesus was or whatever?
So funny enough, even though I've got Jewish heritage, I'm an atheist too.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I think, treat people with fairness and respect, and hopefully get fairness and respect back. I think there are lots of great principles within religion.
Mm.
I think the great challenge of religion is most religion is secular. You're either inside the tent or you're outside.
Mm.
And that's unfortunate, I think, because actually we want everyone in one tent together, don't we?
That would be helpful.
Would be helpful.
Well, on the God thing, you're obviously atheist. we'll talk about sales, I'm sure. Have you always been atheist, or did it take you time to be what made you think it's a godless world?
Look, my family background is relatively scientific.
Oh, yeah.
So my father was a Fulbright scholar, studied under people involved on the Manhattan Project in America when he did his doctorate, is heavily into subatomic particle physics and some pretty radical breakthroughs and concepts there, things like quarks.
Quarks, he was in the quark. Wow.
Yeah.
That's pioneering that.
That's right. And so that sort of viewpoint, there's challenges with science itself, but also science probably tends to poke holes in religion as well. So if you've got a strongly scientific background and belief, it may be less likely you have a strong religious belief, right?
Okay. I used to go to Sunday school because they gave you free food. And my family was atheist, but I was like, fuck it, let's learn about it.
I'll take the upside.
Yeah, there's a lot of upside. It was a good time. Yeah, because I got put in a preschool in America, and, was in Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Right.
Had a friend called Bubba. He played football. Yeah. As cliche as it can be. And they give you donuts, and then you go to church. So
wow.
Learn a bit.
Yeah.
Fascinating story. As far as stories go, they're so out the gate. And they're universally human in a way. Have you ever heard of the hero's journey?
Yeah.
So there seems to be universal stories that resonate with the human condition.
Yes.
And I think that flows into sales in a way, and how to engineer a story that resonates with their problem.
Yeah, great.
I don't know. I was just trying to plug it in.
Look, I think sales, I guess it is about taking people on a journey, isn't it? Mm. It's genuinely wanting to help, and it's genuinely knowing that you can help. And I think if you take sales from that perspective of helping the business owner on their journey get from the current position to a better position, then that can be really powerful when it comes together. It can be a hero outcome, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a fascinating journey. I made a goal to meet 200 people by the 15th of December. Just sounding
on track?
Cool. I mean, I started last week and we've met 25, 30, I don't know. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I love it. But my only goal was to take a genuine interest in the person in front of me and try and add value.
Right.
And then business started falling from the sky. And I was what a funny world we live in. So let's go back to so you're born in Auckland.
Yep.
What school did you go to?
I went to Komarama Primary School.
Oh, one of those beach people.
One of those beach people.
That's where I live. I live in Komarama. It's a beautiful place.
Great part of the world.
Yeah.
And then I carried on to Selwyn College.
Okay.
Yeah.
So were you popular? Were you a weird kid?
I wasn't terribly popular. I was just I was just a Joe average kid. I wasn't weird, probably smarter than average, but not a scholar. Played a few sports here and there, but none too seriously.
What sport?
Bit of tennis.
Cricket. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Were they overprivileged there too?
Not at Selwyn. Selwyn was a pretty broad spectrum. Still remember the first day, the principal greeting us and welcome us to the school, having an assembly and saying, now, as the third formers, don't use the toilets this first year. May not go so well for you.
Oh, we used to call them turd formers,
good old turd formers.
Same with you? It hasn't changed. Fascinating. Hasn't changed. Humans. Yeah. Children are pretty brutal if you think about it. They segregate themselves to the in-group and the out-group and then, you know, brutally alienate the ones outside of it. So the non-conformist normie, we'll call you.
Yeah.
It's a very smart play. You're not too smart, they make fun of you, but you're not too weird that you stand out.
Safety, right? Head below the parapets.
Yeah, well played. There's actually, on a random note, just to continue with this random podcast.
Yeah.
They were doing a study with zebras, and it relates to being in-group, out-group, and Paul Poffy syndrome. So these zebras, they were trying to study them, but they all look the same, so it's quite hard to work out which one they're studying.
Yes.
So they put dots on them, red dots, but then they'd come back and the zebra wasn't there anymore because the predators had killed it. And the reason was because it could uniform their attack on a particular person,
right?
On a particular zebra.
Yeah,
and I think that's
because of the red dot.
Yeah, so you had no red dots at school.
Yeah, and there were kids that had red dots, right?
Yeah, you went for them, the turds.
I didn't go for them, but certainly kids did go for the kids with the red dots. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
What do you think that is? Why do you think humans segregate themselves in groups if that is true?
I think it's tribalism, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We need a sense of belonging. We want a sense of belonging. And maybe it kind of aligns to the whole hero thing, right? Because a hero needs a villain as well, right?
Mm.
So if a hero tribe needs the villain tribe, don't they? You need your friends and your enemies. And if you don't have both, then neither exists maybe, right?
Interesting. Because there's a book, Games Primates Play in Economics and Relationships.
Okay.
Don't read it, shit. But there's one good point. primates can't show affection without an outlet for aggression.
Right, the balance.
Yeah, so it's quite useful, especially in a political playbook. You unify your hate towards something to unify your connection as a group.
Yes, yep.
Build a wall or whatever.
Donald Trump's playbook.
It's great. It works, yeah. So you do the school, you're a normie, you're a turd for a period of time, stayed away from the toilets.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you do after school? What were you studying?
So after school, I came from a relatively well-educated family, so expectation was go to university.
Mm.
Didn't really know why, didn't really know what I wanted to do, so duly went to Auckland, started a BCom. Probably had more life experience than academic experience over that year. Joined the Air Force.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I didn't expect that. It's a fucking side tangent. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Went down to Wigram to be a pilot and an officer. Discovered individualism and the armed forces aren't necessarily a good marriage. Exit stage left.
Did you try and rebel in any way? Entrepreneurial people tend to be quite rebellious.
See, from my perspective, I didn't see it as rebellion.
Mm.
I saw it more as improvement and enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
So what I quickly discovered is when you're told to do something and you suggest what seems like a perfectly logical way to do it in a better way or maybe achieve a better outcome, you don't necessarily get a favourable response in that environment.
No. I got a job at McDonald's and I got fired the next day.
Similar situation, right?
Yeah, I was like, oh, you sure you want to do it like that? But entitled, really. I forgot how they taught me, so I tried to wing it.
Yeah, yeah.
It had to do with pickles, but I worked it out. It was to do with the machine. But anyways, sounds bad when I just say a phallic-shaped thing and it had to do with that. So, okay, you're a normie at school and then you went to the Air Force and you're a non-conformist.
Yeah, so I guess a couple of things I learned in the Air Force. One, I was really good at maths, and that's why I got in.
Hmm.
and two, I was a nonconformist, because even though they'd picked up I was a nonconformist, I'd done very well in math, so they let me in.
What does math have to do with flying?
Math has quite a lot to do with flying.
Okay.
Understanding airspeed, understanding angle of attack, understanding time to distance. Math is invaluable in so many things in life, right? And particularly for a fighter pilot, fast evaluation of numbers and situations to determine outcomes is really valuable. And that's something I'm better than your average bear at. So
interesting.
But equally, I think it also highlighted to them that I thought differently and I probably wasn't a conformist. So I think I came in as someone of interest to be watched closely, and they weren't sure what the outcome was going to be.
How long did you last?
Oh, only 4 months.
What's your take on this UFO shit going on? Like, do you think it's a secret? It's a secret, like technology they just don't want to share yet, or it's a distraction?
I'd say it's 4 months
of experience.
Look, I think it's a distraction. Surely it is.
Interesting.
Right? We people love conspiracies. People love intrigue and mystery. Is there anything to it? Probably doesn't matter in the case of a good story, does it?
It's crazy how little people give a fuck. Like, if we got aliens here, look how unreactive most people are.
Yep.
You know, aliens are among us. We're just going about doing this podcast.
You could be the alien, right?
I could be. I've been told I'm weird, so maybe could be it. I wasn't conforming. That's for sure. So okay, so you do the pilot thing, you realize you don't, you know, get fucked. I'll do what I want. I'm good at math. What about after that?
So what after that? I went into the world of. I started working in clothing, actually, looking after people.
Looking after people.
Yeah. Helping people buy the right clothing, wear the right clothing.
Huh.
I was a retail shop assistant.
Okay,
that's the actual title. I enjoyed it. I did that for a couple of years.
Huh. Was it a sad day when you had to hand your CV in after being an Air Force pilot, or you were like, fuck yeah, I've always wanted to be a stylist ever since I was...
I think I was pretty young at the time. I was 20-odd. Actually, what appealed, I think it was reasonably well paid.
Okay.
Plenty of drinking money.
How did you apply at a job back then? I just assume it's a while ago.
We didn't have job boards.
Okay.
Yeah, so I reckon it was probably an advertisement in the Herald. I was reading a copy of the Herald, and there was a landline phone number to call. Yeah.
And you call them and convince them you have a CV.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I think I met a recruitment consultant, and interviews. Once you're at that point, pretty much the process it is today. But I guess there was no internet, there was no cell phones, there was no social media. So the starting point was different, right? But the bulk of the journey was the same.
I still skip all that. I don't like reading or writing. I can do it. I wrote a book, but
right.
I forced through it. I was like, I'll write in 17 days so I don't have to do it again. So I just fucking wrote a book. But I always just like skip it. So either meet the person. So like in LinkedIn, you can leave comments and engage directly with the decision maker.
Yes. Yeah.
Or you know someone that knows someone.
Yep.
But this is not a useful tangent. So... okay, you do your retail thing. Now you're a style guru. You liked it for a few years.
Yeah. But hey, it's not going to go anywhere much, right? Went back to uni, finished my degree, met my wife, got married.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Where'd you meet her?
Met her at New Zealand's first Desperate and Dateless Ball.
Desperate and Dateless Ball. Is that the official title? Or?
That was the official title.
Wow.
Ray Columbus was the MC. We danced all night.
Desperate and dateless.
Yeah.
Fuck, did you have to have an ego like check just to go, or was it funny, or how did you address that?
So
deep desperateness.
So who was desperate? Who was dateless?
It's a good point.
But neither of us at the end, right?
Yeah. Neither did. Yeah. Okay. Well played. Let's see why you got it sales. Great ejection handle, mate.
There you go.
Okay. So now you met your wife. It's lovely. Dance all night.
Yep.
Then where are we now? You finished your communication degree. Is that what it is? BCOMs?
BCOM. Commerce degree.
Oh, commerce. Sorry.
Yeah. Marketing and management.
Okay.
For whatever
useless?
That's worth.
If you had to put a percentage on the value of it, 100% the best thing you've ever done. Don't include the real life experience, just like the knowledge.
You know it's not going to be 100%. You already knew that when you asked the question, right? What do you reckon the answer's likely to be?
38%.
38. That's specific. Why 38?
Because I wanted to say lower, but it sounded bigger with an 8 in it.
An 8's lucky, right?
Yeah, it is a lucky 8. Yeah. What would you pick?
Do you know what? I think it might be lower, right?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Your generation can't say that. That's fucked up. You got to tell all your kids that you have to go to university, otherwise you're a failure in my eyes as a father.
Hey, my oldest daughter's at university right now. It's a great rite of passage, right?
Oh, yeah.
And she's learning stuff and she's really passionate about what she's doing. Will she rate it 100%? No way. Of course not. But it's part of her life, right?
Well, that's good, man. I feel like you should talk to the other parents. They're like, oh, you know, you're a failure if you don't have this degree you're not going to use. But some are very important, obviously, if it's a requirement.
Yeah. And I think learning how to learn, that's really important.
Mm.
Do you necessarily learn at university? You might. But that's probably as much the right individual lecturer,
true,
the right captivating topic as it's not defined by a degree.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. I was sleeping till 9 in the morning. And then, oh, no, yeah, I'll go to bed at 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
Wake up at 5 p.m., then go to the lab classes, miss all the lectures. And then I didn't even go to the exams at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So Mum thought I was a piece of shit failure. I was like, oh, well, I'll work it out. We came to terms with it. I was just projecting there for a moment.
Yeah. Look, hey, I think what I'd tell any young person about going to uni, do it because it's what you want to do, not because what your parents tell you to do.
You know, there's a book, Way of a Superior Man, that talks about live as though your father's expectations are dead.
Right.
Could just apply it to mom and dad.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people living despite of their parents or for their parents.
Yeah, neither's helpful.
No. Did you ever have that? Because dad's this hotshot smart man that knows about quarks.
Look, I think very smart man. So, yeah, probably felt I lived in his shadow for a while. But, hey, it wasn't his doing. That was just what I decided to roll with, right?
Mm.
No point carrying that on, so you stop.
How'd you stop? What's your advice for someone that's still trying to win over the love of their father? It's a bit hectic.
Oh, woof, that's deep.
Approval? We can change it to approval.
Wait, is it? But probably half the time it's what you think you're trying to do, isn't it?
Mm.
Any half-decent parent, they're not trying to make you love them. They're not trying to make you or expect you to be something you're not. They're just happy you are.
Mm.
And I think sometimes if you've got these sorts of projections, that's from you. That's not from your parents, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously parents, they have their own projections or insecurities. Like, for example.
Absolutely.
Mum had like a chip on her shoulder and I was a reflection of her success.
Yes.
So there is some component of the parents, but then at the end of the day, if you communicate it right and you both, they would just want you to be happy.
Of course they do.
There's some fucked up ones, but their version of happy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some parents. Yeah.
Most, I think, you know, look, I'm a parent now and my conditionality around my children doesn't exist. I just want them to be happy, to have a good life and figure out whatever that means to them. It's not what it means to me.
What do you think your role as a father should be or is?
Encourage them to try stuff.
Interesting.
Have minimal fear of failure. Live. Because you're only going to do it once.
YOLO is what the kids would say these days.
YOLO, absolutely. And all sorts of other acronyms that I don't know.
So how do you instill the not... like the fear of failure, like how do you instill the confidence and curiosity to try things?
That's a tough one. It is so tough, right? Because I talk about giving the gift of independence. Mm. And it bugs the shit out of them. And so one way that plays out is they'll ask me a question. Do you think I should do this? And I'll question them back. Do you think you should? Welcome to the gift of independence. You're perfectly capable of making this decision. The world won't end, whatever decision you make. So just make one.
Mm.
And if you don't like it, don't make the same decision next time. Make a different one. But give it a shot.
When they were doing Goo Goo Gaga at like 2, did you do something different?
Yeah, of course.
Don't do that. Yeah. What's been, I guess, the most confronting or challenging thing on trying to be a father? Like, because I use it as motivation. I have no kids, but I'm like, would they be proud of who I am? So how do I strive to be that? What's been your, I guess, did you shit yourself when, oh, they're pregnant? Okay, now I've got to be a...
haven't hit that hurdle yet.
Okay.
I've been bloody lucky. My wife's an amazing mother, and I think our kids have had a pretty decent upbringing by and large, and I don't think they've had to face too many major obstacles yet. The oldest, she's 19, she's at uni, 19, 18, I tell a lie, advancing her age.
Yeah, no, you're disowned now.
Yeah, probably.
Can't get that wrong. No. What's the date of birth? No, I mean, no.
7/6/2004.
Hey, well, there you go.
There you go.
19. I did it in my head.
Yeah.
What happened to your math skills?
Blew it in front of the mic.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. Look, she and I have difference of opinions on lots of things, but I think that's great. The world is a better place for people having different viewpoints, right? It's what we need. It's how we get progress. It's how we have new. It's how we have potential for better in the future.
So what's your thoughts on this woke culture and the vilifying of people that have different opinions?
I think that's a real problem, right? Because that's the greatest strength of humanity is the ability to accept difference and for people to change their point of view and potentially embrace difference, right? And that's a great challenge for woke, because woke seems to set itself in a position that it can't detract or remove from about an issue. And therefore, if someone has a counter view on that, whatever that matter may be, they're wrong, they're bad, they're evil. How can that be good for society? How can that advance society?
Do you have a limit? Do you sometimes find... because someone asked me, what's the most controversial opinion I have? And then they said, that's not a controversial opinion, which was basically, I believe haters still hate no matter how justified the cause.
Yeah.
Which basically means even if someone's done something horrific, if you hate them, it's still wrong. So do you find a limit to your understanding?
So haters a fascinating thing, right? Because again, if you hate, it will hurt you too, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it will hold you back as well, won't it? So it's not even practical, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I agree.
Yeah.
Surely road rage, though.
But even...
You must have a limit. What pisses you off? Someone like cuts... What's your trigger?
Look, I'm the sort of character, because most of the time I'm pretty relaxed. When I do blow, I probably overblow.
Oh, yeah.
You know? boom. And that's dumb, right? Because I break friendships. And that's problematic for me.
Is that from a need to be liked, so then you keep a certain aspect of how you're feeling at bay? Or what's been the challenge around that?
Yeah, look, it probably feeds from a bit of a desire to be liked, yeah. Yeah. And so maybe things I'm not comfortable with, I might try and go along at times. And probably a bit much better reaction would be actually just to voice, hey, that's not me. I don't think that's the way I'd go about it. But at the end of the day, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do, right?
Well, what's there'll be some people listening that struggle to voice their concerns and want to be liked or have people pleasing. What's been something that's valuable for you to navigate that?
People pleasing is super tiresome, right? It is a massive energy stealer, right? Because you have to try and work at being a fraud, don't you? Because you have to go, even though I don't want to do that or I'm not happy with that, I'm going to pretend like I am and go along with it for that other person. And then it grates at you. You're sucking your own life force away. Don't do it, folks.
Cool. Well, you heard it first.
There you go.
I agree, though. I think... I always use the comparison between kindness and being nice.
Yes.
Being kind isn't always nice.
No.
I find people pleasing is almost selfish. It's like my need to be liked by them is impairing the feedback they need to hear.
Right. Yep.
So I'm doing it for me instead of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think there's an element of that, isn't there? And it's a balancing act, right?
Mm.
I think people pleasing too is, it can also be taking responsibility for stuff you shouldn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because someone's being a bit of a dick today, just because you like them, doesn't mean you have to forgive that or excuse it. But you don't have to hold it and carry it either, right?
Mm.
You can just go, well, that's today. Probably not their best day. I'm sure they might have a different day tomorrow, right?
Can't do that in sales. Can't remember things in sales. You get PTSD.
That's true, right? That's true. Sales is the ultimate form of where you've got to forget the bad stuff. Because any sales career of any significance will have bad stuff in it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It could be a tough market like the present. It could be an unreasonable boss. It could be an unreasonable client. It could be an impossible objective from on high. It could be any manner of things that are outside your control. At the end of the day, if you do your best and you can hold your hand on your heart and say, I did my best, but in this case it didn't quite get us there, hey, you still did your best, right?
What's like on the sales thing? What's like one of the most horrendous rejections you've got? Like, just got you between the eye, or like the promise? Like, I have this one where, like, because people promise so much and they don't want to upset you, and they're like, I'll call you exactly at this time at 10 p.m. And I'm like, hey, you don't have to, just say no. They're like, yeah, no, I'll put it in my calendar. Look, I'm putting it in my calendar right now, and then nothing. I'm like,
but you almost know, right?
You know, yeah.
When it's an overreaction like that, bullshit. So it's probably not going to happen.
Mm.
I think the thing that bugs me the most in sales is ghosting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that's more common these days, right?
That's what I love about B2B. You know where they live. You can say no, it's fine, but I'm here.
Yeah.
Oh, you must have lost my number.
Yep. You can send them a courtesy email, right? Hey, it's looking like it's probably a no. What's really valuable for me is to understand why. What didn't meet your requirements and needs?
Mm.
No harm with receiving a no, but the feedback around why is really valuable, so we can improve the experience for our next client or prospect.
God, the amount of shame they must live with. Like, they go and look themselves in the mirror because they promised Ryan, and then you just give them an out. Like, it, I feel like there's something so valuable about allowing people to save face.
Yeah. Yep.
Not backing them in a corner. It's never.
So my father has worked with the Japanese, and they have such a massive issue about saving face, right?
Mm.
They just can't say no.
That's good for sales, isn't it?
Maybe it is, but maybe it isn't, right?
Not long
term. I would imagine the ghosting frequency in Japan is probably about the greatest in the world, right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't have the ability to say no, but the answer's not yes, what can you say?
Nothing.
Yeah. AKA ghosting, right?
Mm.
And that's actually in sales. You're perfectly happy with no's, right? Because the more no's, you're getting closer to a yes.
Yeah. Have you worked it out? Have you worked out if I get 10 no's, it's worth 2,000 or whatever?
That's it, right? That. Yeah. You know, most salespeople do that. They go, the sale is worth X dollars to me. The probability of the sale is 10%. So, yeah, each prospect, each no is a tenth of X, right?
Mm. You said you sold a million. What's the most expensive thing you ever sold? And it can be over 3 years or whatever, but same client.
Look, I've sold significant IT contracts for IT services in the millions. I've sold research approaching the millions.
They're going to read a book and they're like, that's 2 mil. Or like they're about to research something. What are they paying for that? Go on, do it. Yeah.
Thanks for the scorn, Ryan.
It's called Google. All right, 10 million.
This is before AI, right?
Okay. What would they read? Sorry, you go.
So a couple of pieces of research.
I'm not very people pleasing anymore. So,
no, yeah. I can see this. Well, look, I'm just going to preface it and say we figured out the ROI, and the ROI was about tenfold, the purchase price.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. It's worth it.
Absolutely.
Okay. We've done 34 minutes of quality content, just in case you're wondering.
You guarantee it's all quality content, do you?
I find it interesting. Whoever's listening, you know, up to you. Okay, that's a lot of money, and yeah. I start shaking over $20, and sometimes I'll sell something for $60,000. But it's, yeah. I'd say it's tied into your self worth as well to be able to sell something.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think not necessarily your self worth, but certainly I think professional salespeople need to believe in their proposition.
Yeah.
And actually, maybe the more correct term is ethical salespeople need to believe in their proposition. Right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't believe in your proposition, then
I'm still back on the research thing, sorry. If you don't believe in it, then yeah, you're full of shit. You're a charlatan, huh?
Yeah, you are, right?
Mm.
And look, there are charlatans.
Yeah. Like if wife asks, does my ass look fat in this, you know? No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't bring your wife into that context. But you know what I'm saying? Like it is hard at times to tell the truth. And to me, the most valuable thing is the truth.
Yep.
For my state of mind, even just lying to myself. I find it hard to lie to other people, but it's pretty easy to lie to myself.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not doing this because of this rationalization. So on the... How long would it take for you to convince someone to be like, yo, 2 mil? Did you ever get sprung where it's like 10 minutes and they just get it? Well, how do you sell something for millions of dollars?
Particularly B2B sales, you've got to demonstrate the return on investment.
Okay.
B2B sales, people are spending or investing money to buy that service, that product, that solution, whatever it is, because it's going to have a positive return, right?
Yeah.
If they're spending $2 million, it's because they're going to generate 5 or 10. And I think if you don't understand that business case and you can't work that through with the customer, then a large B2B sale, you might fluke the odd one, but you ain't going to sell many.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's to me like. I haven't gone up to millions yet, and I'll let you know. I'll let you know when we get there.
Do.
I feel like you just write, like, if you can prove it, like, you just say it, and then they're like, yes, if they can afford it. So, I imagine there's not much variation between selling something for 1,000 and selling something for 10 million. Maybe the level of trust is higher and the proof of concept.
Look, I think the trust is higher. Yeah. 10 million, there absolutely will be a proof of concept. 1,000, there won't, right?
Mm.
The process is so different.
Okay.
The length of the time it takes. The steps the buyer's got to go through to satisfy themselves to spend $1,000. You know, the buyers in a business that are signing off on a $10 million expenditure, what happens if they get it wrong?
Yeah. They're axed.
They're axed, right?
Hmm.
So the process they go through to validate themselves is so different.
Mm.
The time, the involvement, the steps. That goes way beyond trust, right? They've got to have deep validation. They've got to have, at a bare minimum, they've got to have significant amounts of evidence. And the reality is they've probably actually got to just about have proof, right?
Mm-hmm. Was part of it empowering them to communicate it to the key stakeholders, or you making sure you get around all the key decision makers? Or?
When you're in those millions, you get around all the key stakeholders and decision makers. Because otherwise, if you try and empower people to convert a message and deliver a message, you've got a very real risk of Chinese whispers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Third-hand information will be... won't be 100% accurate, will it? Probably be more than 38%, but it'll be somewhere between 38 and 100, right?
What made you 38?
I don't know.
Move on, okay? University has some pros. Nah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so 38. Yeah. So you try and get... What's the real art of that? Is it getting in front of the key people? Is it having a clear process that documents the outcome? What do you think makes it successful?
So there's a number of key factors, right?
Mm.
You've got to have a reason for them for why they should meet with you.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to understand what they need to achieve, and you've got to bring value to the table in terms of how you can help them achieve that, just from a decision-making process, right? So there's lots of sayings and sales. Look, I've done real estate sales as well, and one they love to trot out there are buyers are liars. Mm. I think real estate sales is a bad example because
they are liars. So what's that?
The whole ethics piece, right?
And, yeah.
Incredible salespeople. There's massive question marks over that industry in that perspective. But coming back to B2B sales, if you're dealing with a large, significant sale like that, and you're dealing with executives that are involved in making those decisions, guess what? They're time poor for a start, right?
Mm.
They've got multiple competing priorities. This might be your number one priority. What priority is it for them?
Yeah.
Because guess what? If it's number 10 or lower, you're in trouble. How are you going to make it important enough to them for them to spend the time with you and to provide you with the information you need to understand in terms of what they need to achieve?
Yeah.
That becomes real challenging.
Mm-hmm.
You're challenged to meet 200 people, right?
Yeah.
That's the number one priority to you.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it to those 200 people you're going to meet?
Oh, not, yeah. You need a reason to meet. Unless your brand is helpful, but.
Yeah, you've got to figure out really quickly how you're going to deliver value to them, right?
Yeah.
And give them the compelling reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just for a meeting and a podcast, right? Mm-hmm. No harm, no foul. But you want to meet this person so they can sign off millions of dollars? They might have a little bit of natural meeting avoidance, mightn't they?
Yeah, until you surprise them with the money. Third meeting, then they're like, ooh. Yeah. Yeah, not sure they have apprehension, so you need to reassure it, and they need a reason to meet you to juggle their priorities.
Large enterprise sales can have hundreds of steps involved.
Mm.
And they need real expertise across every step, because potentially if you get a no at any single part of the process, that's the end of the process, right?
Mm. Jeez. So there's a long, long period of time between getting paid. When you come in, you're like, and they're like, here's a phone book. Or like, what's it like? what support do they give you on that? Were they like nurtured? It's usually some kind of phone book. You know what I mean? Like they call it, oh, I've got this new state-of-the-art fucking leads that we're paying this for. It's like, it's a phone book, but it's specific.
No.
No.
So those enterprise sales, right, at a bare minimum, you'll be dealing with a known organization. There may well be executive relationships between the two different organizations.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a sales methodology within that organization for how they conduct their enterprise sales. And a lot of that will be around how they qualify and validate opportunities they're going to pursue.
Mm.
Because just if the potential payoff is 10 million, but the chance of success is below 38%, are you going to pursue it?
You can't keep. I've been trying to stop giggling since your research thing. Keep hitting me with the fucking 38. Yeah, not here.
So there'll be a conscious decision in terms of those low probability opportunities, whether or not they pursue them.
Yeah.
And it may be no, right? Because actually, by validating the characteristics of the opportunity and the alignment, and maybe it's an opportunity you can't win.
Mm.
And just because it's a huge payoff, if you can never win it, isn't that kind of insane to pursue it?
Yeah. How do you identify between your weak excuses and actually that it's the reality? You know, like, so the rationalizations.
So enterprise sales methodologies will have typically have probably between 10 and 20 really important criteria. And that'll be a combination of things. That'll be about, some of those will relate to the specific opportunity itself. Elements of those will relate to information about the target organization that you want to bring on as a customer, or may already potentially be a customer for other services. And some components will relate to the organization you're acting as the enterprise salesperson for, their capabilities, their characteristics. Because what you're talking about is a dating methodology, right? What things align, what things don't.
If only they're desperate and dateless, then
it'll be... If only they're desperate. You get me back on the 38!
I don't know. This is for the last 20 minutes. I'm just trying not to laugh. I don't know why. You got me good. And here's you giving these great, valuable points, and I'm just sniggering over there.
But it's, you know, again, B2B sales, regardless of whether it's $1,000 or $1 million, actually, you still need a process, right? Because actually, again, even if it's just the $1,000 option, if the process and the information tells you you're never going to win it, why bother starting to pursue it?
Mm. Just on that, so, you know, the growth scientist side of things. Yeah. So you go help these people.
Yep.
What is something that you often find is the lowest hanging fruit or the biggest impact that can be made?
So as you can tell, I take a lot of, I bring a lot of thinking to the table and a lot of experience around sales process.
Mm.
The steps, the components to what achieves success versus what's going to head you towards failure, i.e. the no versus the yes. That's the Americans are really strong at that. You go to any large American organization, they will have a sales force that gets regular professional development and training.
Mm.
They will have potentially their own process that is unique to them, but it is understood by their entire sales team. It's followed on any significant opportunity. They know how long their sales cycle is. They know what their win probability is. They know their average value of deal. When you're talking with a New Zealand organization, many of them will have way less than 38% of this information at hand.
You're a fuck, eh?
But seriously, a lot of what I do as the growth scientist is I come in and I sit down and...
You can't do that to me. I was doing so good there. And you fucking... Yeah.
I sit down with them and I review, what do they do in terms of sales process today?
Mm-hmm.
What is documented? What's consistent between the way salesperson Ryan conducts their process versus the way salesperson Simon conducts their process versus the way sales manager John coaches and trains them and enables them? Do they know their sales cycle? Do they know their typical win probability? Do they know what their ideal customer looks like? What are the key differentiators in terms of their service offering or product offering versus their competition? Who is their competition? How do they specifically win against their competition?
Yeah, not many would go that depth. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah. And so I spend probably, it's not unusual to spend a month with an organization learning what is actually known about the way they conduct sales, and actually what's just, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Don't really know why it does work or don't really know why it doesn't work.
Mm.
Well, coming back to growth, if you don't know what's working, how are you going to grow and do more of what's working?
Yeah, makes sense. How do you know? Do you just ask them or you look at their data or?
So I get whatever data they have. I talk to whatever customers they'll let me talk to. I talk to their salespeople. I do a friendly interrogation.
Friendly interrogation, yeah.
To find out what do they actually do and what do they track and measure themselves. So again, you know, we talked about that payoff, right? The value of a no.
Yeah.
Again, I'd suggest, if you had 1,000 salespeople in New Zealand and you asked them, can you tell me the value of a no?
Yeah, I don't know. That'd be one.
You'd get such a variation of answers. But again, if you look at the American model of training, documenting, learning, creating data, documenting process, documenting methodologies, learning from their previous mistakes, refining their process so they have a higher win rate tomorrow.
Mm.
You just don't, it's very, very uncommon to see that same depth around treating sales as a science versus an art form. Oh, John's really good at sales. We don't know what he does, but customers come, so they seem to quite like him, so we're really happy with that. Great. So how would it look to have 5 Johns? What do you think they'd do? What would it mean to your business? Oh, I don't know. You know, if sales is an art, you've got no idea whether it's going to grow or decline over the next year.
That's valid. I used to work for one of the biggest face-to-face marketing companies that no one's heard of, called APCO.
APCO, okay.
Have you heard of them?
No. There you go. Maybe there's a 38% chance I have.
I thought about reading 38 into it. No, there's they're in 27 countries and
pretty much, 38?
Not 38. I wanted to. Yeah, I try to round it up.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but they had a methodology. They basically flog everyone else's products and put on different colours. Right. That's why you don't know who they are. So pretty much the majority of Australia and a lot of New Zealand, the charities with them.
Ah, okay.
And they'd get people to lock in and stay for like 3 to 4 years and they had a really clear process. And you're right. You highlight how little, because it's an American company.
Yep.
How little documented process there is, and people, they don't know. And the level of effort people put in to acquire client, it's just like, oh, you had 5 coffees this week. What are you fucking doing with your life?
You're
a salesperson.
Yeah.
So how do you? What are your thoughts on that?
So you know, if you've had 5 coffees with the same prospect. And you're still saying things like, the opportunity looks really good, right? You're clearly doing a bunch of things wrong, aren't you? If you don't know what the opportunity is, how big it is, why you'll win it, why you'll lose it, when they need it by, what they need it for, what that's worth to them, guess what? They might like you. They might enjoy a free coffee, but you're probably not the prime supplier from their perspective, because they're not even sharing information with you, right? Again, you know, it's in B2B, businesses need to do their top 5 things, and they will do those. Their top 10 are probably helpful to do. Anything beyond that, they're probably unlikely to do. So wasting your own time and wasting their time by having a coffee for no purpose, there's going to be no commercial outcome out of that.
And we just ruined my whole fucking thing till 15th December. It's been going good. But yeah, it's interesting.
I think, you know, Kiwi, she'll be right. It's a really affable, likable characteristic of a typical Kiwi, right? But it means we sometimes do things a bit half-assed, a bit slapdash. Or we don't even know why we do things. Or we don't even know what we're expecting to get out of them. If you take that approach to sales, you're in the art of sales. And the outcomes are going to be unknown.
It's crazy. Like, if you actually... we've done 52 minutes. If you actually think about the... There's the rule of 100, is the Alex Hormozi guy told me about. He basically... either spend $100 in advertising or make 100 minutes of content or make 100 outreaches a day.
Yes.
And then 2 months, provided you're not selling donuts, you're going to have, you know. So, like, you think about that. It's like just the idea of someone doing 100 cold outreaches a day. Maybe you could be more strategic and maybe you could be targeted. Like The Ultimate Sales Machine is a good book you might like. And, like, recruitment, sales, marketing, it all is all just because people are being little wusses and not making the outreach. And also, you know, they're not learning or how to do it.
Yeah. So cold calling is a great activity to undertake, right?
Yeah.
And particularly if you're not afraid of a no.
Yep.
Because if you ask them, oh, hey, that's great, doesn't resonate with you, why? And get some feedback. So then you're getting a bit more targeted and scientific, right? So the first 100 might be a shot in the dark.
Yeah.
And 99 might be no's. But guess what? You've got a lot of information about what's a no. So you might have some insight into what's a yes. So the next 100 might be so much more productive.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I mean, there are people a bit special. Because I used to train salespeople at that company. So you start off, people scared me. So that's why I chose it as a occupation. I thought that'll fix it. Didn't.
Right.
But now I can communicate better.
Good.
And then we trained these salespeople, and they were just so uniquely different in the way they approach these, the way they think.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the early mistakes I made was like, so because I had no finesse and I was shitting myself every day, I just like, oh, I'll talk to 40 people a day.
Yep.
Get rejected by hundreds and I'll make sales. And then I try to teach people. I'm like, you do that. And they'll just get their soul destroyed. And they're just like, but they're like sniper and relationship oriented. Do you have like a process to identify key people and their attributes and how to support and nurture that?
Yeah. So fundamentally, there are two types of salespeople, right?
Okay.
There are hunters and farmers, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're trying to specifically win new business and you don't want to manage accounts, you're a hunter, right?
Mm.
And that'll be characterized by, actually, you've got a much higher aptitude and tolerance for cold calling.
Mm.
You'll take 100 no's and you won't even bat an eye, right?
Mm-hmm. Guess girls what? Have conditioned me for that at the club.
Yeah. The farmers, right, that ain't going to be the same. Mm. When I work with salespeople, it's about helping them to understand if they're a hunter or a farmer, because not many are both. That's unusual. And even if they are both, those that are truly 50-50 each, I think that's incredibly unlikely.
You think they're full of shit? And shame them?
No, not at all. I think they don't understand themselves well enough. They'll have a natural inclination. Again, you're probably not 0% farmer and 100% hunter, but actually salespeople can be quite extreme. So I think 90-10s do exist.
38-62.
There you go. You got it in.
So that's, the math was off. No, yes, yeah, right. Yeah.
No, that's right. That's right. Man. Bang on.
Straight from the pilot himself. Yeah.
There you go. So help salespeople understand what they are, right? Because if you're focused as a farmer, but you've been given a hunting assignment, that ain't so smart. Mm. Nurture the existing customers, right? Get the referrals that way. Be the hunter. And if you genuinely are an absolute hunter, pass on the referrals to the hunters.
Do you ever facilitate anything for farmers in the sense like I would see them as very relationship heavy, a fearful of rejection. So if they had a soft landing with a prospect,
yeah,
instead of like the cold outreach, this arms folded, what the fuck, how does it cost? Yeah, and they're I hate this. Do you think of that as well? It's still
yeah. So because a really great
that 38.
A really great farmer, right?
Yeah.
Actually hunts within the existing accounts, right? Because there's more opportunity to do more business with that same customer, right?
Mm.
Often.
Yeah.
So I think, again, B2B sales, the relationship, your piece, right? It's got to be honest.
Yeah.
May not be nice. But that might be kinder, right?
Mm.
And it's going to be much more practical from a commercial relationship for both entities, right? Because both parties know what they need to know.
Sure. Cool. Well, we've done a whole last podcast. I like to abruptly end it for retention. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Ryan.
Done.
Don't forget the Growth Scientist.
Growth Scientist. Shout out. It's in the link.